Genesis chapter 50 is where we're going to start reading here in a moment. Genesis chapter 50. And if you turn to that, that'll give me just enough time to say how much I've enjoyed being with you all. You know, it is a great blessing to go and preach somewhere where you immediately feel at home. And that is exactly how I have felt this weekend. So thank you for opening your hearts and encouraging me in the work. Thank you for all the good that you do here, and pray that the Lord will continue to bless you all in what you're doing for the kingdom. Genesis chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us, pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you." I just wonder if Jacob actually ever said anything like that or not. "And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your fathers." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." Now, whether Jacob ever actually issued such a command for the brothers to go to Joseph and ask for his forgiveness, there's no questioning what Joseph said to his brothers in verse 19. Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." As I talked with you about in class this morning, this principle given here in this text, that God can work through the evil that people do and that they suffer to bring about a greater good, this principle is exactly why the argument against the existence of God based on the problem of evil and suffering doesn't really work. Because if you can show that God can work through the evil and suffering he permits to bring about a greater good, then the argument fails, as it does here in the case of Joseph in Genesis chapter 50. There is no question that his brothers did what was evil. They say as much, if you look back up at what we read in verse 15. But there is also no question that God was able to work through that evil to bring about a greater good. I think I mentioned to you this morning in class that I was going to ask for some, in fact I did in class this morning, ask if you could think of some ideas. And what I want to do in the lesson tonight is look at three stories in the Bible that I've picked out that illustrate this point. Over the years, whenever I've talked about this subject, I've always asked the audience at the end of the lesson, when we shake hands, if you can think of another example, give it to me. Because I got to have something to preach this coming week down in Valrico. So you can actually help me do my lesson. And so I've been keeping a running list. And I would love it if you all added some new ideas to the list of stories that illustrate this point. What I want to do, though, is I want to begin by tracing in more detail this story, the story of Joseph. So if you would, go back with me to chapter 37, Genesis chapter 37. Joseph said his brothers meant evil. We're going to learn why they meant him evil here in Genesis chapter 37. It says in the middle of verse 2, "Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father." So here's one reason they don't like Joseph. Joseph tells his father when they do what is wrong. And I want to be clear here that what's going on in this account is not simply that Joseph is a tattletale of some kind, that he tells on his brothers, you know, for staying up too late or watching the TV too loud. No, if you know the book of Genesis, and you know, for example, what Levi and what Simeon did to the city of Shechem, or you know what Judah does in the next chapter to his daughter-in-law, then you know that these boys are capable of incredible evil. Not to mention what they do to Joseph. So that's one reason they don't like him. Verse 3 says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him." So now a second reason, favoritism, which anytime you read in the Bible a story about people who are in these kinds of marriages with multiple women and they have multiple children by multiple women, this kind of thing almost always happens. Here's a third reason, verse 5. "Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more." And he says, here's the dream. And you know the story of these dreams. They are dreams which show Joseph's brothers falling down and bowing before him. And in verse 8, his brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. That is the third time, by the way, that we've read the word hate. Verse 4, verse 5, and verse 8. Such a strong word to use for anybody, not to mention your own brother. And of course, we know from the New Testament that the one who hates his brother is a murderer. So maybe it is no surprise what we read next. In verse 17, Joseph is sent to go down to Dothan to find his brothers to see what they've been up to by his father. Verse 18 says, "They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams.'" If you've ever been to Memphis, to the scene of where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, the Lorraine Motel, it's been turned into the National Civil Rights Museum. And outside there's a stone, and on the stone there is this inscription taken from Genesis 37. "See, here comes this dreamer. Let us kill him and see what will come of his dreams." But the dreams that Joseph had, of course, were dreams that came from God himself. And it is this man, this virtuous man, this man who is given dreams by God, that the brothers intend to murder. Verse 21 tells us that the oldest of the sons, Reuben, hears about this and decides that what he will do is, when he has an opportunity, he will take Joseph, cast him into a cistern, later rescue him. The problem is, Reuben apparently steps away, and while Joseph is down in this pit, Judah says, "You know what? We're not going to make any money off of our brother if we murder him. So let's sell him into slavery." And the opportunity arises in verse 28 when Midianite traders pass by. So they bring Joseph up out of the pit and sell him into slavery. This story is so familiar. It is easy for us to just take for granted what happens here. In the first place, in the ancient world, just like in the American experience, slavery was not only a degrading experience for the slave, it was a dangerous experience in which your life was easily exploited, if not taken altogether. But not only that, think about this from Joseph's point of view. When he is down in the pit and he's hearing his brothers basically talk about his life as if it is merely a commodity to trade in. In fact, later in chapter 42, when Joseph has risen to power and his brothers come before him, but they don't recognize him, they tell us something in this chapter, chapter 42, that we don't learn in chapter 37. Glance over in chapter 42 and verse 21. 42:21. "Then they said to one another, 'In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen.'" So we aren't told this in chapter 37, but what we learn is that when Joseph was down in that pit, and he hears what his brothers are talking about, Joseph was begging for his life. He wasn't thinking, "Someday, West Carrollton congregation, is going to have a VBS, and I'm going to be one of the main characters, and I'm going to be a big hero. Someday they're going to make a Broadway musical about me. He thought he was about to die, and we need to remind ourselves of that sense of emotion and what Joseph suffered in this account. Well, you know how his story unfolds. Chapter 39, he ends up in the house of Potiphar, where, as has often been the case with slaves, he is exploited sexually, accused of rape. He ends up in prison. And of course, in all of these stories, whether in his father's house, in Potiphar's house, or even in the prison house, Joseph, by the hand of the Lord, succeeds and rises. And yet then there's always a dip in the story. I heard somebody suggest, and I think this is undoubtedly the case, that the low point for Joseph must have happened at the end of chapter 40 and the start of chapter 41. You remember the stories with the baker and the cupbearer, and they have dreams and Joseph interprets them, and it's bad news for the baker but good news for the cupbearer. And as the cupbearer is about to return to Pharaoh's service, Joseph simply asks him, "Remember me." And the end of chapter 40 says in verse 23, "Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." And then the next verse says, "After 2 whole years. That's the point. Whoever it was I was listening to said that had to be the low point for Joseph. Because you've tried to do everything right in all of these different circumstances, and now you've just asked this guy, "Just remember me before Pharaoh," and you are forgotten, and you're forgotten for 2 years. Think about it. 2 years is basically how long we've been in the pandemic. And it seems like much longer, but I bet it didn't seem as long as those 2 years seemed to Joseph. Well, then you know the story. After 13 years of enslavement and imprisonment, Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh. He's given the position of managing the affairs with grain to feed the whole world. And the pivotal moment comes in chapter 45 when Joseph finally chooses to reveal himself to his brothers after he hears Judah, the same brother who had openly talked about murdering him, offer to trade his own life for Joseph's full brother Benjamin. And when he hears this, in chapter 45, verse 1, he could contain himself no longer. And he reveals himself in verse 3, "I am Joseph," and immediately asks about his father. And then in verse 5, he says, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me here before you to preserve life." Now wait a minute. Which was it? Was it the brothers or was it God? And the answer is yes. The Valrico, they're used to my terrible trick questions now. They know the answer is always Jesus or yes. All right? So in this case, the answer is yes. It is both of them. It is the brothers who genuinely did what was evil and God who genuinely worked through that. In verse 8, he says it again. "It was not you who sent me here, but God. He's made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his house and ruler over all the land." Now, what's interesting here is Joseph, I'm sure, when he was down in the pit, did not think, "Oh, this is the hand of God at work." I'm sure those 2 years when he was languishing, forgotten in prison, he didn't think, "Oh, this is the hand of God." But now, in retrospect, after many years, he sees that God has worked through the choice of his brothers to put him in a position to save not only his own family from starvation, but the whole world, almost like a down payment of the promise to Abraham, "Through your family, all families of the earth will be blessed." But it happened because of the evil that his brothers chose to do. One last detail, by the way. Go back over there to chapter 50. Do you remember what Joseph dreamed that caused his brothers such hatred? He dreamed that they would bow down before him. Did you catch the detail? I didn't. I'm going to connect this for a long time. In chapter 50 and verse 18, his brothers also came and what? Fell down and said, "We are your servants." But here, it's not in a churlish or resentful way. Here they do so willingly. And what this shows me is that God can work through our evil and suffering to bring about a greater good, and not only that, but to fulfill the desires of our heart in ways we never anticipated. If we are allowed to say that dreams reflect what's on our heart, and Joseph had these dreams of his brothers bowing down, now, in addition to everything else, the dream of his heart has been fulfilled. And so, his brothers meant it for evil, God meant it for good. The slave traders meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Potiphar's wife meant it for evil, God meant it for good. That's story number one. Now, story number two I'm going to pick out today. Look with me over in the book of Philippians, chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1. Today, we talked a little bit about the suffering of the Apostle Paul. At the end of the book of Acts, Paul is sent to Rome in custody. And I think that's where he writes the book of Philippians. And the evidence suggests that the Philippians have heard about Paul's imprisonment. They've sent him some financial support, and Paul replies to thank them. That's in the letter of the Philippians. In the course of this letter, though, he wants them to know about how things are going. So listen to what he says in Philippians 1 and verse 12. "I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel." Now, wait a minute. How could putting the Apostle Paul in prison serve the greater progress of the gospel? Well, he's going to tell us. He says three things have happened. Number one, verse 13, "so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ." I take this to mean that he has had access to a group of people, the imperial guard, that under normal circumstances in his preaching and teaching, he would not have had access to. And Paul says, they know about my imprisonment for Christ. It might even be some of the fellas he's chained up to. So they think they've got a captive apostle, but they also now have become a captive audience. They can't go anywhere. So when Paul starts to do the things we know that he does in prison, preach, pray, sing, write letters, these guys are chained right to him. And at the end of the letter, if you go over to chapter 4, you'll notice in verse 22, he says, "All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household." So number one, there are people who have heard the gospel that may not, under normal circumstances, have heard it. Here's a second reason, if you go back to chapter 1, that he says things have actually worked out better for the gospel. He says in verse 14, "And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear." Here's what Paul is saying. Other brethren have seen my fortitude in imprisonment, that I'm not intimidated, and it has encouraged them, and now they're doing more to preach the gospel than they would have had I not been in prison, and as a result, more people are hearing the gospel. And then here's a third reason Paul gives. Verse 15, "Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment." Here's what Paul is saying. There are some preachers who are so crazy, their mindset is, "I bet the Apostle Paul wishes he was free and unhindered and able to preach like us. So here's how we're really going to get his goat. We're really going to go preach it up. And then he's going to learn about all that we've been doing. And boy, is that going to make him mad." I mean, these are crazy people. But what Paul says is, you know what? Here's all I care about. "Only in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that I rejoice." So for those reasons, Paul says, "I'm in prison. But look, more is being done for the gospel than had I been free. And so those people who caused Paul's imprisonment at the end of the book of Acts, like the Jews who instigated riots against him, they meant it for evil, God meant it for good. The Roman governors who wouldn't give him a fair shake that leads to him to appeal to Caesar, meant it for evil, God meant it for good. The crazy preachers meant it for evil, God meant it for good. And by the way, if I were to ask you, what do you believe was the greatest desire of Paul's heart in his work? It was to see the gospel go forth. And now, as it turns out, that desire of his heart is being fulfilled in ways he never imagined, greater than he ever imagined, because God meant it for good. All right, now, pause just a moment. Are you thinking of your stories? Are you just sitting there like lazy bums, or are you actually going to help me out? All right, so I want a good list of stories at the end of our time together today. Before I go to the third one I've picked, I want to make just a couple of points of application. In the first place, could I say kindly as I can, having suffered like you have suffered, that for the reasons I've talked about today, it does not make good sense to give up your faith while you suffer. And the reason is, when you are in the middle of your suffering, you have no perspective to know what God may be up to working through it. When you are in the valley of shadows, vision is very obscured. I don't think that Joseph had a clue through much of his story, in the pit, in Potiphar's house, in prison, what God was actually working to do. That story took over 13 years to unfold. And I'm not in any way suggesting that I can predict with absolute certainty in your individual stories how God is going to work through it to bring about good. I'm just saying, none of us have the vision in the moment. We're too close up to what's going on to see what God may do. But we can take hope and confidence in all of these stories that we are looking at, that God can do something and is up to something. And then have the patience to see what it may be. Here's the other application. Since that is the case, since we know that God may be up to a greater good than we can imagine, but we don't know for sure what that may be, all we can choose to do is, in the moment, look for ways to be faithful to God. Joseph looked for ways to use the gifts God gave him at every step along the way in his story. Paul is looking for ways to have a positive impact, even though this was not what his travel itinerary had in mind as he began to preach the gospel. And then trust that even though we cannot really read the book of Providence with any clarity or certainty, that what we can choose to do is to be faithful in the moment. And trust that God can work through us. All right. Now, one last story I want to talk about tonight. And it's from what is quickly becoming my favorite book of the Bible. I think it's okay to have favorite, but we shouldn't have least favorite. But I mean, I think it's okay to have a favorite. And here's the book I want you to go to. The little tiny book of Philemon. Philemon just has one chapter right before the book of Hebrews. You know the backstory of this book. Philemon is a Christian who lives in the city of Colossae. He has a servant whose name is Onesimus, a common slave name, which means helpful or beneficial. Onesimus decides to flee before the time was going to come. Typically in the first century, you were set free at age 30 when you were a servant. Onesimus decides to get out of Dodge. And apparently, don't know this for sure, this reconstruction is only partially certain, but it appears as if he goes to the city that would be the easiest place in the Roman Empire to disappear, the giant capital city of Rome, where the Apostle Paul is imprisoned. maybe the only person in Rome Onesimus would have known about because of Paul's relationship to Philemon. And through that series of circumstances, Onesimus comes into contact with Paul. And Paul teaches him the gospel. And Onesimus becomes one of those many children of the Apostle Paul, people he's converted. And now the Apostle Paul writes to Philemon to ask him to be reconciled and to forgive Onesimus. And when you consider what Paul says in the book of Colossians, that the work of Jesus Christ is a work that is for the slave and the free, then this story takes on a greater significance than just one personal dispute. Because what's going to happen here is this is a chance for the gospel message to be lived out in a real circumstance, requiring grace, forgiveness, and reconciliation. So, Philemon, verse 10. I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whose father I became in my imprisonment. And then Paul makes a pun off of his name. Formerly he was useless to you, but now he is indeed useful to you and to me. I'm sending him back to you, sending my very heart. I would have been glad to keep him with me in order that he might serve me on your behalf during my imprisonment for the gospel. But I preferred to do nothing without your consent in order that your goodness might not be by compulsion, but of your own accord. I could order you as an apostle, make him free to come and serve me, but I want you to do this freely. Verse 15. For this, perhaps, I love the humility and modesty of Paul. He doesn't presume to read the book of Providence with certainty either. But he does suggest, perhaps, this is why he was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever. No longer as a bondservant, but much more than a bondservant, as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you both in the flesh and in the Lord. Now, in this story, there is no evidence that Philemon was a harsh or cruel master. There is every reason to think that he was the kind of master Paul describes in the book of Colossians in chapter 4. So what Onesimus did was wrong. And not only that, there is evidence later, according to what Paul says in verses 18 and 19, that Onesimus may have very well stolen from Philemon to fund his journey. So a wrong was done. But I want you to think about what Paul says has happened as a result of this. Number one, Onesimus has become useful. He's actually the best version of himself now because of Christ, which, by the way, is true of all of us. The best version of any of us is the version of us that is in Jesus Christ and becoming like him. And to play psychologist just for a moment and to assume that the reason Onesimus ran away is because he felt like he was not being all that he could be as a slave and he wanted something better. Well, it turns out he has found something better, much better than he ever anticipated. He is now in Christ. He is useful. And if we were to ask ourselves, what does Philemon want? The answer would be, he wants his slave back, finish his term of service. And what does Paul say he can get? Something better. Not just a bondservant, but a brother, a beloved brother. And he says at the end of verse 15, you might have him back, not till he finishes his tour of duty. You could have him back forever. How could this have even happened had Onesimus not chosen to run away? And yet through his choice, do you see what God has done? The good that God is working through this First of all, for Onesimus to become a Christian. And secondly, for Philemon to have a relationship that transcends just a business relationship. A brother forever. Onesimus meant it for evil. God meant it for good. And now they can each have the greatest desire of their heart. Onesimus is the best Onesimus he can be. And Philemon can have him back forever. And if you ask me, Shane, what do you want? You know what my answer is. I want Christy. And you know what the Lord says? Well, you could have her. You could have her forever. Much more than a wife, but as a sister forever, whose beauty in the resurrection in the eyes of Christ would be much more radiant than I can even begin to picture. That is the great hope and confidence we have, because we know that God means it for good. And I hope that these things will encourage you as you deal with the suffering and adversity that you face in life. Of course, for Christians, it's not exactly a newsflash that God can work through evil to bring about a greater good. After all, the heart of our faith is the cross of Jesus Christ, which is the ultimate evil that has taken place. But through that, God has brought about the greatest good of all, our redemption from sin. And if there is something you need to do in order for your life to be right with the Lord, to receive the benefits of the saving death of Jesus Christ, whether it is to be baptized into Him, trusting by faith that just as God raised Him from death to life, He can raise you from death to life, you should do that. You should do it today. You should do it right now. And if something that you need to do in your life that can even be another story of God working through evil and suffering, through bad choices people make to bring about a greater good, to prepare you for eternity, then make those choices. Make those changes. Let God work through you. And let us know how we can help while we stand and sing together.